All righty, that brings us to Batson versus the Salvation Army.
Okay.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Cheryl Legree, and with my co-counsel, Brian Sutherland, we represent the plaintiff, Ebony Batson, in this matter against the Salvation Army. We're here today, and our appeal, obviously summary judgment, was granted in full to the Salvation Army in this case, and we believe that the district court erred in granting summary judgment to the defendant here. I think Ms. Batson had several claims, ADA discrimination and retaliation and FMLA interference and retaliation. In March 2013, plaintiff Ebony Batson supervisor Major Everett Wilson made the comment that everyone has to work in this department. We can't have sick people. That comment came within a couple of weeks of Major Wilson deciding to eliminate Ms. Batson's position. More importantly, that comment came within a few weeks of a February 26, 2013, official ADA request for accommodation for Ms. Batson's multiple sclerosis and the grant of, on March 11th, of intermittent FMLA leave to Ms. Batson. We are not suggesting for a minute that that is direct evidence of discrimination. However, we think that it does show the intent here with all of Ms. Batson's claims. Ms. Batson was an 11-year employee of the Salvation Army and had good performance reviews throughout her employment with the Salvation Army. In November 2012, Major Wilson took over the territory in which Ms. Batson was an audit manager. Ms. Batson, with a new supervisor, asked to have a meeting to discuss the accommodations that she needed for her multiple sclerosis. And the accommodations really were pretty minor in the grand scheme of things. Her job was a heavy travel job. She traveled every week. What she needed as an accommodation and what she got as an accommodation until she officially requested it was that she was allowed to alter her travel plans on one way or the other to accommodate her doctor's appointments and also the fatigue she suffered as a result of her multiple sclerosis. Her doctor also, in the official accommodation request on February 26, suggested that she may need to work from home from time to time. And that's something that the Salvation Army allowed. In January of 2013, Ms. Batson applied for FMLA leave. And everyone, by the way, knew that she was applying for FMLA leave. Major Wilson, Mr. Durache, her other supervisor, Regina Davis from Human Resources, all knew that she was applying for FMLA leave at this time.
Let me interrupt you just for a second. Sure. I just want to make sure it's clear. Was Ms. Batson given any accommodation after she submitted the formal request?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. So that was when you said that she was, that was previous to that point?
She was accommodated until she officially requested the accommodation. She officially requested the accommodation because after Major Wilson took over, she felt like she was being treated differently because she had to alter her travel schedules. Was essentially what it boiled down to. And she asked them to talk to them repeatedly, and the meetings were canceled for one reason or another. Once she was sick, once Major Wilson left early and decided, oh, we'll meet in April instead. So she went to her doctor, and she got these forms from Human Resources, by the way, when she went in to say, I'm not sure what's going on. I'm not sure why I'm having these issues with FMLA. I'm not sure why I'm having these issues with my supervisors not being willing to talk to me about my accommodations. And so she officially applied. That's the right thing to do, I would say, under the law and under any circumstances.
Was there, just to make sure I understand, was there an occasion after she was refused the accommodations, as a general matter, where she actually tried to get the accommodations and they weren't given to her?
There wasn't, Your Honor, but I think this is a really unique situation here. On March 22nd, Ms. Batson was told, your accommodations are denied. On March 29th, she went on FMLA leave and didn't return until May 27th. On June 4th, she was told her position was eliminated and she was no longer had her job with the Salvation Army. So there really wasn't any time for them to, she didn't work for a long period of time and was denied her ability to travel or flexibility with her travel. But that's because she wasn't at work. She was on FMLA leave.
Can you help me with the law in this area? If a person is told, we're not going to give you any accommodation, does the law say anything one way or the other about whether you have to then try to get an accommodation, even though you've been told as a blanket matter you're not going to get it?
Not that I found, Your Honor. I mean, she was explicitly told. I believe that's direct evidence that her accommodation was denied. At that point, McDonnell Douglas doesn't apply. They have to say why they didn't give it to her. In this case, I suspect that the reason they would say they didn't give it to her is because they decided to eliminate her position in March.
And with respect to the FMLA interference claim, no showing of intent is required.
No showing of intent. It's the ADA failure to accommodate claims, FMLA interference claims are interesting in that they really don't require the type of proof of intent that other discrimination claims require. You know, it's in this circuit that if you prove that you were that the company failed to accommodate you, the only answer then is, was it an undue burden? And they have not suggested that here. With the interference claim, it is, did it have anything to do with the FMLA leave? Salvation Army's argument is that it did not, because her position was eliminated for valid cause. You know, whether it was or wasn't, I think what's much more important here is that Ms. Davis was told to transfer Ms. Batson into the position. Ms. Davis then said to the Salvation Army, to the Territorial Finance Commission, no, I can't do that. We have this affirmative action plan, which, by the way, was not produced in discovery. But let's assume for the sake of argument that they have one. The Territorial Finance Commission, and remember, this is sort of a paramilitary organization. These are majors, and she's a civilian employee. After she said, no, we have to post the position, they said, no, we're standing by our initial directive to you. Transfer Ms. Batten into this position. And it's important to note that Ms. Davis knew the FMLA was approved on March 11th, the intermittent FMLA, that the accommodations were denied on March 26th. So she knew all of this when she refused to transfer Ms. Batson into the position. I think there's an even more important issue here, which is, let's say they had to post it. They did post it. Ms. Batson was the only person who applied. Why didn't Ms. Davis transfer her into that position at that point? She was the only internal candidate. And then, after Ms. Batson was interviewed by Major Bolt, they left the position open rather than put Ms. Batson in the position. She was the only candidate. They denied it to her. They posted the position for external candidates. Frankly, Your Honors, I just don't understand how summary judgment was granted in this case. My client was discriminated against. She was, you know, she suffered FMLA interference and retaliation. With respect to the exhaustion of administrative remedies issue, I think we need to address that issue. What the district court said is Ms. Batson did not exhaust her administrative remedies because she didn't check the retaliation box on the form. We're not suggesting, and I think that the briefs aren't clear on this point necessarily, and there's case law in this circuit, by the way, that goes both ways on this issue, but we're not suggesting that Ms. Batson's intake questionnaire was a charge of discrimination. What we are saying is the investigator had that intake questionnaire that had the retaliation box checked, that said June 4th, that said June 28th, 2013 as dates of termination when she was doing the investigation.
So your argument is that we can look to the questionnaire as clarifying.
It's clarifying. It's simply a clarification. And on the face of the charge, what Ms. Batson said, and by the way, Ms. Batson didn't draft it, the investigator did, said, I requested an accommodation in February 2013. My last position with the Salvation Army was audit manager. The accommodation was denied. I wasn't told why the accommodation was denied. I believe I have been discriminated against based on my disability under the ADA. So I don't know how you say under the facts of this case that her disability claim was not exhausted. So then the question is the retaliation claim. The box wasn't checked. Under the law, asking for an accommodation is protected activity. The date on the charge said June 4th, 2013 as the last date of adverse action. That was her term. That was when she was told, your position's gone on June 4th. She engaged in protected conduct. She was denied the accommodation, and she was let go. We believe that on its face, under Gregory versus the Department of Human Resources, a case from this circuit, that's enough to bring the retaliation claim in. In that case, the plaintiff in that case checked the sex box on her claim, did not check the retaliation box. The charge was filed after she was terminated, and the court said, that's enough. Your retaliation claim is encompassed in your charge. So we believe that's binding here on this case and that the district court should be reversed on that issue. With respect to the pretext issues relating to the retaliation claims, where an employee fails to follow policy, and there's two policies at issue here, right? Let's assume for the sake of argument that, oh, I see my time is up. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. Good morning. Evan Ponce on behalf of the Salvation Army. If I may, let me start where my opposing counsel was sort of finishing on the administrative remedies issue. Just to briefly say, this is not a box-checking case. There is a litany in her briefs of box-checking cases. If the only argument here was, well, they didn't check the box, I'd agree with her. But it's so much more than that. She recounted the charge itself. It says, I wasn't accommodated. They failed to accommodate me. That's disability discrimination, period. The only reference to anything beyond that is the June 4th date over in a different box, which wasn't an argument made until the appeal for this court. So there's a problem with that to begin with. But even if this court will honor that argument and consider it, there is nothing about the charge that gives any significance to the June 4th date. And she wasn't terminated on June 4th, despite her contentions throughout. The record is very clear. Ms. Batson came back from FMLA leave on May 28th. She was reinstated to her job. She worked. On June 4th, she was told her job was being eliminated. There was a posting for a job she had done before, which she could apply for, or she could find another job. If she didn't find another job in a period of time, at that point, she would be terminated. She applied for the job. She didn't receive it. She didn't apply for any other positions or find another job. She was terminated. All that happened in June. In July, she filled out an intake questionnaire. After filling out the intake questionnaire, she filled out a charge. Well, the EEOC filled it out, and she signed it under penalty of perjury. She didn't say, this charge is missing all these things. She didn't file an amended charge. She didn't make any effort to point to any other cause of action under the ADA except for a failure to accommodate. It's exactly what the district court found. It's exactly what the law finds. All the cases, whether dealing with the checkbox or related issues, are cases where there was something in the substance of the charge. That's the Gregory case. You've got to look at the narrative, it says. Look at the narrative. There's nothing there except failure to accommodate. On that point, Judge, you asked about the failure to accommodate. There is no law that says saying you're not going to accommodate but never taking any action violates the law. That's what we have here. Ms. Batson managed her schedule. She telecommuted. She came early. She came late to audits. She scheduled her appointments. She did all these things. She decided she was worried about those continuing. But they never stopped. They never changed. There was never an instance in the record. And to the contrary, when she was asked in her deposition, did you get all the time off you wanted? Yes. Were you able to schedule your things the way you wanted to? Yes. Were you able to telecommute? Yes. The only change was for staff meetings on Friday mornings, Major Wilson wants us all here. Otherwise, you can still work from home and telecommute.
And just to be clear, was that all that still true after the formal request for accommodation?
Absolutely. Nothing ever changed. She was already on FMLA leave at the time of the accommodation. It was intermittent, but she was working, and none of that changed. She came back to work after FMLA leave. None of that changed. The only thing that changed was, in the interim, there had been an approval to eliminate the position. And on the position elimination, the record is crystal clear. This was a job created for a specific purpose, because the prior major who was over the audit department, was ill. He needed more help. That major, regrettably, had passed away. He had been replaced by someone who said, I've now got three administrative heads in my small department, me, Mr. Durache, Ms. Batson. There were two before me until Major Broom was sick. I'm here. I'm not sick. We only need two. I don't need that position anymore.
If we get to the failure to select her for the senior auditor position.
Sure.
Can you discuss the interview questions? Those do seem a bit troubling to me.
Well, they're not if you actually look at what was asked, because this was a form interview. And the record and the testimony of Major Bolt was those were the same questions she asked to every candidate, because she interviewed candidates after Ms. Batson. She also didn't hire them, even though there were no record of disability, no FMLA leave, no anything else. She was very particular. The job required at least 75% of the time travel. And these were audits in the field. And the practice, it was sort of like being a consultant. You left Monday morning, if not Sunday night. You were there all week. You came back Thursday night or Friday morning. And it was very important to her to make sure that her auditors were able to do the job, to be present for the audits, and especially a senior audit manager, which the record noted, as Ms. Bolt, Major Bolt said, was one of the lead people. So she was simply laying out the facts. She was doing what lawyers like myself counsel our clients to do, lay out the essential functions of the job and ask the employee, can you do it? There was no discussion of Ms. Batson's disability. It never came up.
Well, in the email that Ms. Bolt sent, she says, I need to be coached on the questions I can ask. So she clearly was aware that there was an issue with respect to the illness.
And there is a dispute about what she was aware of versus whether it was simply, this is the first time I'm doing this, I want to make sure I'm doing it right. But let's assume, Your Honor, that that's a reasonable inference, that she was aware because Ms. Batson had been on leave and they worked in the same department. There's nothing wrong with saying, tell me what I can ask and what I can't ask. I think that's smart for a manager who's going into an interview, so I don't make a mistake. Let me be conscious of it. So she didn't say, you're on FMLA leave, aren't you? She didn't say, I know you have this illness or that illness, don't you? She said, this is how we, as a department, manage our doctor's appointments. We try to schedule them for Monday morning and then leave for an audit. We try to schedule them for Friday afternoon and come back early. Or if you need something else, you've got to get permission from your management to handle it in a different way. Can you comply with that process? That's not an objectionable question under the ADA.
But aside from the questions, the emails go farther than that to indicate that she doesn't want to hire Ms. Batson even before the interview, which would tend to show that her statement that Ms. Batson wasn't hired because she was combative is pretext.
Your Honor, I'd have to correct what I think is an error. The record was Ms. Bolt testified, Major Bolt testified, she expected to hire Ms. Batson before the interview.
Well, right, but I think the emails undercut that when she says we backed ourselves into a corner.
Oh, that's a email from the Major Wilson email you're saying? Major Wilson unfortunately sent an email which says she didn't have performance review problems with me. If we don't hire her, you're going to get a legal claim.
Okay, well, she says that she hoped to meet with, I guess it's Wilson she's talking to.
Right.
And find out if we could appoint a different person in that position. So there's at least some suggestion that before the interview, Ms. Bolt doesn't want to hire Ms. Batson.
At most, there is a dispute of fact over that, but there's no connection to her concerns about hiring Ms. Batson that you're pointing out. And the connections that the plaintiffs are trying to make to her illness, they work together. They were coworkers for many years. It could have been about that. We don't know. That was not explored and developed on the record. On the record are clear, undisputed reasons why Major Bolt decided not to hire Ms. Batson for that position. And plaintiff quarrels with them. She disagrees with them. But as the law requires, she does not take them on head on and rebut them. They are left unrebutted. The interview was terrible. The issues with her performance that were brought up were unequivocally true. Yes, she didn't receive a negative performance review, but she had problems with these audits. She missed deadlines. She did not do an exemplary job in this role. And Major Bolt decided, based on those things, a poor interview with a very bad attitude and some performance problems, I'm not going to hire this person for that job.
Well, Mr. Durault
or Durache?
Durache, yes. Thank you. He has some conflicting testimony about her behavior in the interview. He says she never raised her voice.
Right.
And he understood how she might be concerned with the fact that she was told she was going to get the job, and then that not, didn't seem to be the case.
The process was less than perfect, Your Honor. I'm not going to stand up here and say this was a textbook case of perfect.
But aren't those questions a fact, whether she was combative or whether that was pretext?
I don't think it is, because what matters is the decision maker's reasonable perception. The decision maker, Major Bolt's reasonable perception was, I was asking this person, can she comply with these procedures? Can she follow these rules? And her response was, I know federal law. I can follow federal law. That's a very odd, combative response in a job interview to a simple question of, this is how we handle these scheduling matters. Can you comply with that?
I didn't have the specifics when I asked you before. Sure. So let me ask you about this specific portion of one of Ms. Bolt's emails. She says, I would like to know if there are any questions I cannot ask. I assume that if this candidate is applying, then the candidate can first do the job professionally, and there's some more, and second, is well enough to travel at least 75% of the time.
Right, which is a requirement for any person who's in the position. And that's true. That's an essential function of the job. All she's doing, Your Honor, is laying out the essential function of the job. She's saying, is this person qualified for the job? Had Ms. Batson said in her interview, Major Bolt, here's how I can meet those requirements by this accommodation or that accommodation, that would have been the Salvation Army's obligation to consider those requested accommodation. None of that was discussed. None of that came up. Ms. Batson didn't say yes or no to the questions. She combatively said, I know my rights under federal law. And that, to a hiring decision maker, said, this is a leadership role within my team. This is a team concept of audits. They're under pressure to, on site at a different location, go through the books and figure out if there's been fraud or malfeasance or misuse of donor funds. This is, again, this is the Salvation Army. These are donor funds. This is a charity and a church. And they like people who can work together and do this job well and efficiently. And Major Bolt made the decision that based on her performance and based on these reactions in the interview, she was not the best candidate, not a good candidate for the job. Now, again, Your Honor, you may disagree with that. Counsel may disagree with that. Certainly, Ms. Batson disagrees with that. But that's not the issue for the court. The issue for the court is that a legitimate non-discriminatory reason, which the court found it was? And did the plaintiff offer pretext, evidence from which those reasons are unworthy of belief, cannot pass the smell test, and there is no evidence? All plaintiff says is, I don't think I was combative. I didn't raise my voice. She wasn't accused of raising her voice. We don't have a situation where Major Bolt said, well, you yelled at me. And Ms. Batson said, no, I didn't. Ms. Batson says, I wasn't combative. Major Bolt says, I felt her answers were combative. And Mr. Durache said, her tone of voice was combative. Even if she did answer the questions, her tone of voice was combative. So you've got the decision maker, Major Bolt, saying, I felt it was combative. I felt the answers were insufficient. I felt her problems in the job were sufficient enough for me not to hire her. That's her discretion, her choice. If plaintiff can rebut that with evidence that shows there was some issue here, there was some reason here that was beyond that, that's not the truth. That's a cover for something. Well, that's not worthy of
belief.
And
the plaintiff says the concerns about her medical condition were being covered by this combative idea.
Sure, but there's
some of those concerns were expressed prior to the interview, contrary to Ms. Bolt's statement that she was prepared to hire the candidate until the interview.
I think those emails are simply a question of, I'm aware of something. How do I handle this properly? I'm expecting to hire her, so I assume if she's here, she can meet the essential functions of the job. That's what would be expected of any employee, with or without accommodation. Now, Ms. Batson actually said in her briefs that she could do the job without accommodation or with accommodation. There's some confusion about that in the arguments. The court said very clearly her testimony was, and this is the undisputed testimony in the record, she said she could do her job. She had no problems doing her job. There was no accommodation declined. There was no accommodation not given to her. There's nothing she can point to that says, I couldn't do my job because of this. In some ways, Your Honor, if you accept the argument that plaintiff's counsel, appellate counsel is making, that simply saying we're not going to accommodate you is enough. She didn't do anything in reliance on that statement. She didn't change her behavior. She didn't do anything at all. Then if an employer says, I'm going to take some negative action against you in the future, but it never occurs, then that's an actionable claim. The mere statement would be an actionable claim by their argument. That's not the law. There must be some actual adverse action, a failure, an actual failure to accommodate, a termination, a failure to promote, a failure to transfer. Something has to happen to Ms. Batson, and nothing did here.
What if you have a situation where the employee, and I don't know if that's the case here, a hypothetical, where an employee asks for an accommodation, is told that she can't have it, and then doesn't take any accommodation?
Well, if the employee can say—
Based on what she was told.
I don't take an accommodation. What happened to the job? Did she continue to do the job, or did she say, well, I couldn't do the job now? If she can't do the job now without the accommodation, sure, she's failed to be accommodated. If she says, I need this. I need you to build the ramp so I can get in the office. No. Well, I tried to get in the office. I couldn't get in there. Or I quit because I knew I couldn't get in there. I didn't come to work because I couldn't get in
there. There has to be an absolute inability to do the job.
There has to be some actual activity where the job isn't done or where the employee says, I can't do it. Ms. Batson's own testimony is, I did my job. I always did my job. Now, according to Ms. Major Bolt, she didn't do it all that great, and her interview was not good. And those are all legitimate, non-discriminatory reasons. The failure to transfer, there's this argument about Ms. Davis and this argument about policies. What it comes down to is this. She testified that she genuinely believed there was an affirmative action policy that she must follow. And as her role in human resources, this is what she must do. She must post the job. She must go through the interview process. That's what she believed. There's no evidence to the contrary whatsoever.
Thank you,
counsel. Of anything else. Thank you.
I'm going to address that last issue first. Ms. Davis did not say that Ms. Batson had to go through the interview process. She only said that under the affirmative action policy, as she understood it, that the position needed to be posted for internal candidates and that they needed to hire the most qualified internal candidate. Well, Ms. Batson was the only person who applied. She'd done the job for 11 years with good performance reviews. Why she wasn't transferred into that position when no one else applied? It's unfathomable here, unfathomable. It can only have to do with the fact that she needed the accommodation, which Ms. Davis had already told her was going to be denied, and it's because she was using FMLA leave. With respect to the opposing counsel really seeks a hyper-technical argument with respect to the exhaustion requirement. It's not what the law requires. And if you look at the district court's opinion, the district court did address the issue about what is in the charge, can it be expanded enough for the EEOC to have investigated what happened here. On June 4th, Ms. Batson was told, we've eliminated your position, you no longer have it, you can apply for new positions. That's on the face of the charge. And she said she was failed, they failed to accommodate her, and she believed it was because of her disability. I want to talk about Major Bolt. I think it's really important to note she didn't want to hire Ms. Batson. She didn't want to hire Ms. Batson from the beginning. She knew Ms. Batson was taking FMLA leave, and there's evidence in the record that she did. And she sends this email saying, is she well enough to travel 75% of the time? If that's not proof of her animus here, I don't know what is. And I think that's proof of pretext in this case. Ms. Bolt didn't want Ms. Batson because she knew Ms. Batson needed accommodations and would need leave under the FMLA. Here, summary judgment should have been denied, and this case should have gone to a jury trial for the resolution of these factual issues. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. We'll be in recess.
Okay. She made a point.
I think one of the last one.
No, I did not.
She no longer works for the Salvation Army.
She got fired.
Yes, she did. She has a, as you kind of identified, a difficult personality. And it is unusual. There's no way around the fact that when other officers say, do this, and she says, no, that's not a normal reaction. Oh yeah. we can argue about what her real intent was, but for my opinion, and I knew her pretty well at the time, if she believed something was right or wrong.
Okay, but why didn't she move her into the position when she was the only one who applied?
And you know, it's a good question. My guess is, and obviously if we ever get to trial, we'll find out because
I'll always wonder the question.
Well, I know that's your position. My guess is that what she said is, I don't think I ever really answered that question. Because I never, until the appeal, I never really thought about that part of it. I sort of looked as the transfer of hiring as one big thing. Mm-hmm. And I think what you identified as there's sort of two moments. There's the, why did she just transfer when we know the candidates? Why did she force her to go through the interview? I think what Regina would say is, that's what I thought I was supposed to do. Just like I was supposed to post.
But she never put that in writing.
And that may not be. I think that's more of my guess is she never really thought through that it was just when you post a position and you interview, it's the classic, I'm an HR person in a little HR box and I only know my HR box and I don't step out of the world. There are lots of HR people who are not like that, that are really good and really thoughtful, really good picture.
That's what she needs you for.
Well,
and we're here because of it, and they paid a lot of money because of it.
There's no question. I mean, look, I said, now, who knows what would happen down the road, and how well it's sort of gone on and off. She's done a good job of seeing the other.
I think it would have been fine.
If she didn't do a good job of seeing the other, it would have been problems.
I think it would have been fine, and I think she still would have been there.
But yeah, so I mean, for that, maybe she was a bright person. I remember her.
Someone who has been out on medical leave. Can you do it?
She's hypersensitive. And that's something that Major Bolt certainly didn't understand how hypersensitive. Some of the dispatchers upset from even little things like, you know, when she came back to work on the day she thought she was supposed to come back, and there was definitely confusion about that. It took a while for her to actually get back to her job working with her computer was locked out of her, and she was pissed.
That Rendrick Nash sent her out again. Is he still there?
it was a cluster. That was a cluster. Somebody comes back to work and you're not ready for them to go and you send them back out and then by the time you think, she's upset.
She just gave her job back.
Well,
because Bolt hadn't hired anyone at that point.
I think I remember the deposition, it was a long time ago.
Yes.
And then interviewed like three or four
months. Bolt
really came up with that position. Sure. Why. I think that's one of those situations where if you were in a department and you're all of a sudden head of the department, you've got years of, when I'm in charge, I'm going to do it this way. And that's looking for the perfect candidate, which there is no such thing.
Yeah.
But.
You know, it's
good. It's good.
You're good. You're fine.
Well,
get ready for the next one.
Oh, yeah. No more arguments today, are
there? No, that's it. We're done for the day.
Marshall downstairs also. Yes. Serious business getting in here.
Yes, sir.
It's funny. Everybody had sort of the same reaction. This is harder than the airport. I'm like, well.
That's right.
Exactly. You know. And in many ways, it's a good thing. If I was a judge, my name is public information. My work address is public information.
Yeah.
I'm dealing with all kinds of people who have all kinds of very serious concerns, prison cases, and everything else.
Yeah.
And there's been too much history. I can only imagine the things that are sent in the mail that turn into nothing and are nothing, or idle threats, and yet they're regular, let alone the actual instances. So I've been in courthouses, especially federal courthouses, with people, you know, witnesses or clients or whatever, always the meanest of the state. Federal marshals do not mess around. It's sort of like Secret Service. It's very much the same goal. You have one mission.
That's right.
These judges say, what are you going to do? And if anything doesn't fit with that 100%, it can happen anyway.
Exactly. So, you know, they make sure that we follow the policy and procedures.
And
a lot of times they're the ones that kind of stress it, you know, to us. Especially with Norm Electronics, essentially.
I was curious about that this morning because I hadn't been for an argument about 5 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, in that time, the district court's gotten much more liberal about phones for lawyers.
That's right.
And so I pulled in this morning and I saw a little box and I said, yeah, nothing changed at the 11th Circuit.
That's right. Yeah, here, because, you know, as you know, that.
Yeah, at the Russell Building.
Yeah.
Blue cards.
Blue cards. Yeah, good.
Yeah. Go ahead, this 165. Yes, judges are in conference.
Temple, we'll do, and we'll advise.
Yeah.
It's sort of thing, but you're right, good cards are good. And so you.
Well, and I'm amazed too because, you know, they built that new.
Right.
Temple, we'll do.
They built that new space for the security so that you're outside the physical building, but most of us still come in through the gulch.
That's right.
So you're already in the building,
which
is, to me, that's a concern.
Yeah.
If I were there, it's money. I would have built a little something outside of that gulch.
It's money. See, here, if you notice the entrance, it didn't exist. They built that,
the whole thing.
That you know, kind of fishbowl that would come into it because they had to try to build it to accommodate, you know, this facility in the way it is, so they pretty much
use it. You can't go out onto the street because you got to know.
Right.
And I was wondering too when I parked if there was going to be a different entrance because, again, it'd been 5 years and I didn't know if they had, on a different side, had room on the alley or whatever to take those. I'll let you know. But it's nice to meet you.
Yep. Same here, sir.
You too. Have a great one.
Constant radio transmission.
Yep. 10-4, man.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's always something in your ear, you know.
Yeah. I can only imagine trying to relax for a bit, you know, have a conversation. Sorry about that.
Oh, you're fine.
All right, take care. All right, take care. Hey, Tony. We dropped the key or something. Supposedly back here, but I don't see it. I just called in the radio. It was a key, you know, one of our locker keys downstairs for cell phones. But you know, people say, well, I think I dropped it upstairs. Or I'm turned out of my times. You know, or they'll say, you know, they'll call you. Because we have like a master, we can still get it. They'll call us and they'll say, I got home, I got back in my office, and sure enough, it's in my purse, or it's in my wallet, or, you know, in my sport coat or my quick jacket. And then